Hello, podcasters. We get right into the controversy on today's podcast. Yes, the thing that everybody is talking about, the most important question of possibly our age. Tom Brady, is he a good parent or a bad parent? Pat joins us for that. Also, Boris Johnson has won the election. We talk a little bit about him with Alexander Hammond over in England. Joe the Plumber has come up strangely again, and waxing Romney. You'll understand when you hear it all on today's podcast.
You're listening to the best of the Glenn Beck program.
Home buying season is upon us. Real estate conditions are looking excellent for most of the country. Equity is on the rise. Rates are low. Prices are affordable. Your dream home is within reach. But if it's your first home, your next home, your forever home, you need to get the right financing. May I recommend American Financing? In 10 minutes, you can start the pre-approval process. I've known them for years. I started doing commercials for them after the crash of 2008. They're the only mortgage company that I've ever done or would ever consider, because they called me before the crash and they didn't get their people roped up into crazy loans. They don't take commission from the banks. So what happens? They find the right loan for you, so you're not behind a giant boulder rolling down a hill when the economy changes. AmericanFinancing.net, the smart thing to do. AmericanFinancing.net, or call 800-906-2440. America's home for home loans. AmericanFinancing.net.
Ilhan Omar.
So Ilhan Omar, we have our special on her tomorrow, and you know, we were trying to find a way to explain this whole marriage between her and her brother, and we had no idea how to do that. We decided we were going to do it through kind of a did we name it That 70s Show?
It's a working title.
Working title. The show is tomorrow, you know. Because we were going through, it's kind of like All in the Family. It's a little like the Brady Bunch, maybe Gilligan's Island. We're trying to figure out a way, because it's a very complex story, but one that everybody needs to understand. Because there are some felonies involved here. And the evidence is a little overwhelming. Now, we're going to bring you up to a place to where I think this needs to be going to a grand jury. There's just no way to go past this. At this point, it has to be answered by her, and you know, the FBI needs to be involved if anybody is interested. By the way, while everybody is focusing on the racism of Donald Trump, has anybody noticed what Ilhan Omar has done? She has come out and asked Congress to stop supporting Israel and support the boycott and divestment of Israel.
I love that, because people are like, well, one of the big pieces of evidence that she is anti-Semitic is this BDS movement. She's like, let's put it in the law. Okay.
All right.
Well, you're not fighting. I wouldn't say. It's like they're like, oh well, is Donald Trump racist? He said he wanted that people on the both sides are good people, and then people question him about it. He's like, well, you know what? KKK is coming to visit me today. It's like, well, right. Wait a minute. Wait. Whoa, are you?
In fact, we're going to write it into law that they get a national holiday.
Yeah,
what?
Okay, all right. I guess they solved that one for us.
Here she is. She says she's not. This is not anti-Semitic. She's just protecting the people, the Palestinian people, from the Israeli occupation. First of all, there's never been a country named Palestine, and the so-called occupation is just the.
Well, there's never been 94 genders either, but that didn't stop anything.
So she says that everybody should boycott Israel. And she says that Jews have hypnotized the world. She has used tropes about, you know, the money-grubbing American Jews.
Sounds so much better with this music in the background.
It does, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. With, you know, they have dual loyalties to Israel while spreading conspiracy theories about AIPAC. She says also that the Jews own the Republican Party. And she has also scoffed at the idea that Israel was... even a democracy.
I would laugh at the idea that Jews own the a Republican Party, except for the fact that that would be the typical way Republicans would do it. Like, the Republicans are there, and they still only get, like, 25% of the vote from the group that
that
runs
may be
them.
The evidence. That may be the evidence that they do it, and they do it kind of crappily and never, ever get any credit for it.
Alon Omar.
So our Alon Omar update and our special is tomorrow. We ask you to subscribe to The Blaze. If you're already a subscriber, thank you so much. This is going to be a good one. I have a feeling there's a lot of comedy in this one.
There is. And I think it's most useful to people, besides the fact that you get to laugh and probably hear that song again.
And others.
it's almost a musical. It's almost a musical at this point.
It is.
But I think just being able to visually understand what she's being accused of is really important because it's really complicated.
Yeah, and that is honestly why we started with the Alon Omar, is because it's so complex. And so we started... You know, we started with one 70s show, and then as we went, we were like, well, it might be more like this 70s show. And I'm not sure if we're going to be able to decide by tomorrow. It might be all of the 70s show to try to explain exactly what's happened. Now, I will tell you that Stu claims to have run out of time to act out, be Alon Omar as a sock puppet. Mm-hmm. He claims that... You know, I guess he's used to Shakespeare, where they have weeks and weeks to memorize lines. And so I'm still trying to convince him to play Alon Omar as only Stu could play her as a sock puppet. That is on tomorrow's television broadcast. Please sign up for The Blaze right now. You get Steven Crowder, Mark Levin, all of them. There's like 40 now. And you can watch the shows whenever you want. Things are heating up at the Blaze TV. Sign up now. You'll save $10 if you use the promo code Glenn, blazetv.com, promo code Glenn. Did you see that AOC has a challenger now?
Yes, I did see this.
Yeah.
I mean, you kind of have to believe that she's very safe in her particular district till the end of time.
Well.
Maybe not.
Well, the Republican challenger. Now, I understand that you get, you know, you get what you can take at, you know, places like her district. Mm-hmm. But this is the Republican challenger. She admitted to the New York Post that she voted for Barack Obama in 2008 and 2012.
Okay. Well, all
okay.
right.
Okay. All right. That's happened. You know, there's some...
There are a lot of people who did that. I mean, he won both elections.
Yeah.
You know, you're in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
You know, probably mm-hmm. hard to find mm-hmm. people who didn't do that.
Right. Mm-hmm. Last June, when Ocasio-Cortez won against the Democratic incumbent, she tweeted, "Congratulations, Alexandria. Queens is headed in a new direction, and it's time for new leadership. Hashtag yes."
Well, I mean, I guess you could say they certainly were headed in a new direction. And now maybe that was just the person saying, look, it's time for new leadership. So like almost like, you know, announcing the campaign, you know, mm-hmm. maybe didn't mean
all right, so
Ocasio-Cortez per se.
So here's, I mean, that would be, you know, you could claim that if it wasn't that she also posted with her congratulations the CNN article with the headline, 28-year-old Democratic socialist just ousted powerful 10-term congressman in New York.
Okay, yeah, that takes a little bit of the right. shine off of my right. theory there.
Right. Then she tweeted on Friday because people are like, wait, are you really a Republican? She said, well, I was hopeful when AOC won. You know, she took on a Democratic political machine and won, but nothing's changed since. Why? Because she's only been focused on her fame and politics of division and hate. We deserve and expected better. That's why I'm running.
How did you expect better from her?
Right. And hope for what change again? What change?
Real socialism this time, right. not just celebrity socialism?
I really, that's really interesting. So the Republicans are at it again. But the good news is, if you get her in, she's not going to stand in the way of any of these evil Republicans that want to cut spending.
Oh, thank you.
It's so close.
Because they are these fiscal hawks out there. It's whoa. Calm down, guys. Yeah, I mean, we have to have a few dollars to run the country. Mm-hmm. I mean, all these Republicans.
The cupboard
do.
Is bare.
Oh, it is.
And,
it is. There's almost nothing left, as Nancy Pelosi told us. And we, at the time, I thought disagreed, but apparently not.
Apparently not. Well, we know that Donald Trump doesn't disagree. He believes in debt. He said that in one of the debates, that he doesn't have a problem with debt. He believes in debt. Okay, well,
some debt is okay.
Yeah, some debt is okay. This one increases by $2 trillion by 2021. Another $2 trillion. What are we up to? 22? Are we going to be at 24 by 2021?
Yeah, at least.
That would be good, yeah.
At least.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's, of course,
If everything goes right.
Remember, we're in a very good economic time.
Yeah, yeah.
So the fact that we're going into all these deficits when the economy is good might lead you to think there's a problem if the economy gets bad.
Well, the good news is saying that we're spending it on all of our sunny days. What's great is when the rainy day comes, there's going to be so much money in the bank for us to be able to handle it.
Because we're beating many of the deficits from the economic collapse now. We're getting to the point where we're putting up trillion-dollar deficits when we're having a great economy with basically full employment.
Yeah.
So if the economy, and I'm sure it's obviously going to be good till the end of time, there's never going to be a downturn.
Never
a
downturn.
As long as it stays as perfect as it is right now, we'll only have $24 trillion of debt or a little more, plus $100 trillion in unfunded liabilities and more.
Did you hear that Elizabeth Warren is warning now of an economic catastrophe? Elizabeth Warren is.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, I just...
Because we're spending too much money. I'm sure that's what Elizabeth Warren is concerned about.
Well, she said, I warned about an economic crash for years before 2008, but the people in power wouldn't listen. Now I'm seeing a serious warning sign in the economy again. And I'm calling on regulators and Congress... She bores the snot out of me.
Mm-hmm.
To act before another crisis costs America's families their homes, their jobs, and their savings. Warning lights are flashing, whether it's this year or next year. The odds of another economic downturn are high and growing. Congress and regulators should act immediately to tamp down these threats before it's too late. Now, she said that yesterday, and boy, do I have some commentary on it, but I thought we'd flip it over to CNN. Now, Stu, I got a gun to your head. I'm going to pull a trigger if you're wrong.
Mm-hmm.
What do you bet CNN is going to say about Elizabeth Warren and her warning on the economy and that Trump has just let things go out of control?
I mean, with no knowledge on this situation, I would definitely say that they would probably be harsh on Trump because they don't know how to do anything else. So that's I would think that they would blame Trump and say that's why Elizabeth Warren is right.
And seeing that she's a social justice warrior.
Sure.
It's got to be great.
And Elizabeth Warren's solution's got to be wonderful. That's
correct.
How you fix it.
Listen to CNN.
She's proposing some solutions that actually might create another crisis. Now, let me explain each of those.
What?
Number one, she points to several data points that say, you know, the alarm bells should be ringing for a financial crisis. Well, one of the things that she points to is the level of corporate debt. Now, while risky loans to corporations have increased post-financial crisis, the ability for those companies to keep up with payments has also increased. So we're not seeing the kind of default rates that would be alarming at this point. Now, I'm not saying that's not a metric we should be paying attention to. All I'm saying is that Elizabeth Warren is shaping this conversation in a way that's politically convenient for her. Now, as far as her policy proposals, she is recommending lowering rents, offering affordable child care, offering free tuition at colleges. All of that costs money, and the American public should be asking, how do you pay for it? One way would be to increase taxes. Another way is to increase government debt. This is the issue that the American people should be actually focused on, because many experts say if we don't get control of our debt over the next 10 years, we could be facing a fiscal crisis, and that would be extraordinarily harmful to our economy.
I'm sorry. I think you're on the wrong network.
Who let you in here?
I think it's time you leave, ma'am.
I expected
the door of her studio to be broken down and the CNN police come in and just gag her and drag her away. That doesn't make sense to me. Wait a minute. Hang on just a second. You're defending the economy and you're also tearing down socialist policies. Have we all slipped through another wormhole? Are we on yet another Earth where occasionally somebody on CNN says something that just doesn't bash Trump and instead bashes a progressive social justice warrior? I'll get back to you. I'll let you know if she still has a job by the end of the day. Then we'll know. I'm excited for tomorrow's show. You?
It's going to be a big one.
Yeah.
I mean, but, you know, I don't know. Maybe we should burst in with breaking coverage of Robert Mueller's testimony in which he reads from the document he's already printed and handed and distributed to everyone. This will be really fascinating at that time when he says the line that we already heard, but we had to read it last time, and this time he's going to say it. So that's going to be a lot different.
Right.
That is going to be riveting.
Yeah. Remember when he was when he gave his press conference and said, Congress, don't call me to testify because I have nothing new to say. Everything in that report is my testimony. So it's going to be exciting.
It's amazing listening to the political analysts talk about this. They're like, you know, this is going to be a huge moment in Washington. And you know, Robert Mueller has said he's not going to give any new information. But, you know, in today's day and age, it is important for the person who did the report to read from it. So that you can, so people can hear it, because they're not going to read the report. It's like, okay, well, I think maybe if there was something in the entire collusion part of it, they'd be more fascinated with it, right? Like, it's the fact that, like, you're saying, well, there's no collusion, but there could have been some things that may have, if people acted in a slightly different way, may have been obstruction of justice, and we want to ask him about that. And he's already said, if you ask me, do I think he's guilty of obstruction of justice? I'm going to say the thing that I said in the report, which is we couldn't clear him, but we couldn't, you know, there wasn't enough there for.
Yeah, but why?
Thing. Well, we couldn't clear. There's a 448 page document. I hope, you know, I hope he does is he takes a copy of the document and he just every time they ask him a question, go, hold on, let me refer to my document, and then just flips slowly through the pages. One, two, three, and then it's like page 271, and then he reads from page 271 the exact paragraph that where he answered the question. I mean, he was thorough. I don't think anyone's saying that he was not. This was not a thorough analysis of the situation. He micro-analyzed every single thing that basically Donald Trump did from 2016 to 2018, and before that, and in some cases. I don't understand what they think they're going to get out of this. I think they're looking for that viral moment, which is this is the freaking U.S. government that's running a hearing because they want to get a viral moment where he states something that he's already said.
If I were to be fair, which is still stupid of them to do, but if I were to be fair, I could say maybe what they hope is they see damaging stuff in there. They see damaging stuff, but the American people just won't read it. So we need to put on a little cake and circus show.
That is basically
and
what
they're bring everybody in. And that way, when he says it and it's a cake and circus show, they're really going to be upset. Wow, you think that little of the American people.
The best of the Glenn Beck program.
Hey, it's Glenn, and if you like what you hear on the program, you should check out Pat Gray Unleashed. His podcast is available wherever you download your favorite podcast. Forget the political unrest. Forget about, civil disobedience. Forget about the debt, Iran. We brought Pat in to talk about the real issue of the day. Welcome to Pat Gray.
Yeah, thank you.
Yes,
it has to be discussed.
Uh-huh.
Is Tom Brady a good parent or not?
Oh, my gosh. Thank you. Finally, somebody,
somebody
is addressing this.
Asking the question that must be asked.
Mm-hmm.
Well, first of all, we had last year, you remember this, and I think we disagreed on the kiss with the 11-year-old son. I found it disturbing. I think you were okay with it,
yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they made out for like 15 minutes.
They did not make out. They did not make out.
It was disturbing.
No, it wasn't.
It's like, okay, stop! And now he went cliff diving in Costa Rica with his 6-year-old daughter. Now, this one is pretty scary. This one's a little different because, first of all, why do you post this on Twitter? You're just opening yourself up to it.
Yes,
and whether
I agree
or not
with that.
Tom Brady cliff dives with his daughter, that's none of my business. Yet he made it my business because
Made it my business. He forced
me to take a stand.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So it's interesting because there's a lot of controversy and a lot of discussion. A lot of people are saying, hey, that's a good dad spending time with his daughter doing, unusual death-defying
there are
things.
Times, there are people that take their kids mountain climbing, all kinds of stuff that I would never do.
Never do.
But that's the way their family is.
I would not do this with my kids. But
I wouldn't do it myself.
The jump is what? 15 feet?
It's not that. The jump height isn't as big of a deal
as the rocks.
As the rocks.
The rocks are frightening because if she lands on the rocks, you're
and
badly injured if
why
not dead.
He grabbed her.
Right.
Yes, because he grabs her as he's jumping in, and he sort of jerks her arm to make sure she clears the freaking rocks.
Yes.
She kind of goes in sideways.
Those who are watching this on Blaze TV, we do have the video.
All right, go ahead and play the video. It's okay, she's standing there before her dad.
Now he grabs her hand, and he seems to be talking about what we're going to do.
Mm-hmm.
Then he asks her if she's ready,
mm-hmm.
I think. You can't hear it.
Yeah,
but,
yeah and she shooks her head, yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Now they're
one,
ready. Okay, here we go.
Two, three.
Hesitation! So he has to pull her.
Okay.
He has to jerk her arm and separates her shoulder. And
separates her shoulder. She's swimming.
Breaks her rotator cuff.
She's swimming to him. I think this is if he was like, you're gonna jump, daddy. I do want to jump.
I don't think it was.
I don't think that was it at all. I think she was like,
I'll do it. But she's six.
Yes. Okay.
At the moment of.
But
actually doing it, it's gonna be
good
different.
Dad. He's a good dad because he did grab her.
Is he? Should he have taken that risk?
Right.
With his daughter?
Well, the risk you're saying once the jump began and
yes,
she didn't want to jump,
dad,
then he was
a
good dad.
He had to pull her away from sudden death.
Yes.
Yes.
The question is, do you put her in that situation at 6 years old? Now, I would say
stop treating our children like they're complete imbeciles.
Okay. So instead, treat them like Acme anvils and throw them off of mountains.
No, I didn't say throw them off of mountains.
This is
she
different.
Said, assuming that she said, "I want to do that. I want to do that. I want to do that." Okay, but here's the thing: you have to jump. You have to jump past those rocks. I know you're capable of doing it. Mm-hmm. You have to jump past the rocks. It's fear that will hurt you. If you have fear, it will hurt you. I'm good, Dad. I'm good. Are you sure? Yes, I'm good. Okay, let's go. She walks out to the cliff. You'll notice she's there first. She walks out to the cliff. I'm good. Are you sure you want to do this? Yes.
I'm sure all that took place.
Right.
But why take the chance?
Well, yeah. And second,
because he knows he's going to grab her and pull her over in case.
And separate her shoulder and break her rotator cuff.
She did not break her rotator cuff or separate her shoulder.
I will say.
And she's clearly a very good swimmer. She's swimming to him.
Yeah.
Yeah, or at least a swimmer. We don't know that she's a very good swimmer, but she's a swimmer. You skip over a very important part of the parenting there, however, is when your six-year-old says, yeah, I really want to do that, you have an opportunity as a father to say no.
No, it's
and
not
that's
safe.
When you as a father have to know your six-year-old kid and know if they are capable of doing it or not.
And right, and he obviously chose incorrectly and that she didn't want to jump.
How many times I've got the greatest, I have the greatest thing. Of Rafe and I jumping into the pool. George Lang was at our house. Have you ever seen this series of pictures?
I don't think so.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah,
I
used
I
to
have
him in our bathroom in New York. Mm-hmm. And there was this whole series of pictures of the two of us running. And he must have been about six. And he's like, let's jump in. Let's jump in. And I'm like, okay, I'll beat you. And then whoever gets in first wins. All right. So we're running.
And you're in full clothes. Right?
I'm in my clothes. I'm in a suit.
Yeah.
And so we're running.
Oh, yeah. I remember that.
Yeah. So we're running and we get to the edge. One, two, three. I jump. He doesn't. Mm-hmm. Okay. And it's not because he thought it was funny. He just at the last minute was like, I'm nervous. I'm not going to jump.
Right. Well, we know that's what happens with 6 year olds, right? That's why yours is not a life.
But there wasn't a rocky cliff you were jumping from.
That's why I didn't grab his arm on the way in.
Right.
And he didn't even move. He didn't hesitate. She hesitated. And I can guarantee you, it's not her just standing there that made him grab her arm. It's the fact that she went and hesitated.
Oh, yeah.
And that hesitation is what will kill you.
Yeah. He had to pull her in. And
he had to.
She basically landed on top
of him. Badly hurt.
It could have been really bad.
Why are we even talking this?
Yeah,
she's fine.
She's fine. And I will say, like, I think.
Would you do that with your daughter? Because she's about that age, isn't she?
Yeah, she's six.
Yeah. Would you do that with her?
No, I would not. Not in that situation.
I wouldn't either.
But just because, like, you know, she's a great swimmer. I mean, she's a great swimmer.
I wouldn't do that with my 30-year-old daughter.
Wait.
All right, honey, let's take your hand. Come on.
Yeah.
Okay, now wait a minute. Would you do it if you had a very daredevilish kind of child at six?
No, she is. Because I'm the adult.
She lives. My daughter Ainsley lives life head first. That's how she lives it. And she is a daredevil, and she will do anything.
Would you? Would you take that risk if you were a world class athlete and knew that you could?
Put a hypothetical to a person who can just answer it. Of course, I am. I am.
That's a Canadian world-class sports celebrity.
Yes, I
forgot. Oh, I forgot.
Glenn.
I mean, look, I
hated Canadian sports celebrity.
Number one, so the social media thing over here is overblown. I mean, it's not the worst thing in the world, right? Number two, Tom Brady in every way is a horrible human being, and he should have all of his Super Bowl rings taken away.
He should be in prison
for his football crimes.
And then the Patriots won't have him as quarterback anymore.
I'm fine with all of that.
So you guys are saying you're not biased.
No, we're not biased.
What if he inflated his daughter just a little bit more than she should have been inflated?
He probably did.
Yeah.
He probably did.
The larger lesson here, though, more than anything else, because look, jumping off this cliff, is it a great idea? It's one of those things that as soon as I started it as a dad, I'd be like, what am I thinking here? Like, what is the upside of this? Like, she could die.
Yep.
So, like, I don't think it was a great decision. That being said, the only real lesson here, though, is if you're thinking, hey, it'll be cute to have this picture, and then it comes out like that, where you have to jerk her arm into the water and she almost lands on your head.
Then don't post
it. Then don't freaking post it.
Yeah.
Like, let's be honest about it. You just don't post it, and then you just avoid all this nonsense.
That's the only part
that shows to me that he's just a bad judge of anything.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay? Mm-hmm. That you thought, yeah, I'll post this. But, again,
what does he carry? He's the perfect life. I mean, guy's got, you know, what, six Super Bowls, Giselle's his wife. He's got, you know, unlimited amounts of money. His wife is making more money than he is.
Listen to that.
Mm-hmm.
You take his picture-perfect life, and you just assume that it's all good. Do you realize how many times he has to drive to the bank?
Yeah, to deposit all that money?
Right.
Oh. Well, he might have direct deposit. Maybe he doesn't have to take the
trip. I'm going to assume he has direct deposit.
Still, he has to look in. I mean, it's
he
easy.
He does have to look at the account, and there's a lot of numbers there to read.
It's easy when you don't have a lot of numbers or the numbers are small.
Yeah.
He's got to figure out, how much do I have?
How many homes can I buy with all this money?
He doesn't.
Can I get another?
His life is hell, Stu. His life is hell. Think of this.
Uh-huh.
He's a good-looking, eight-time Super Bowl champion?
Six-time Super Bowl champion.
It would have been seven, but the Eagles beat him.
Yeah. So he's got all that going on. And do you know how many good-looking women he has to turn down every day?
Oh, well, because he's married to one of the most beautiful women in the world.
That's beside the point.
It's interesting. When he started to get with that woman, it wasn't because he was turning away other women from his previous marriage. But that's a whole another story.
We'll just forget that little detail.
Yeah.
All right.
Tommy, you really shouldn't post anything online.
Right.
You shouldn't post anything.
This is the best of the Glenn Beck Program.
Hey, it's Glenn, and if you like what you hear on the program, you should check out Pat Gray Unleashed. His podcast is available wherever you download your favorite podcast. Stu, would you just do me, let's just make this into like a Mad Lib, and you just take random words that you have and you fill in. Okay.
Sure.
All right. You got it?
Sounds great.
Female waxer who has declined now to handle a male. That's where you fill in any just any word. Okay. A female waxer who declines to handle male
berries.
Well, there's more than just the berries.
Twigs and berries
mm-hmm. could face legal consequences. At least this might soon be possible in the woke insanity, otherwise known as Canada. This comes from a recent British Columbia Human Rights Tribunal hearing. I don't like the word tribunal. Doesn't that sound like it's like you're in real trouble? You know, going to court's one thing. A tribunal hearing?
Right.
Sounds like a
gulag.
Maybe
committed some genocide.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. So Jessica Yaniv brought a complaint against Marcia Da Silva, a woman who runs a waxing service from her home. Complicating matters, Yaniv, despite identifying as a woman, sports the full package of male...
Two oranges and a banana. I don't.
I was hoping that you would, you know, come up with something a little less graphic.
Oh, okay. But this is, you were not clear of the rules of this game.
Just said pick some random words and just throw them in there. According to the Toronto Sun, Yaniv responded to an advertisement Da Silva posted on Facebook and sought out Da Silva's waxing services. However, upon learning that Yaniv retained her
junk. This is much better, right? You wanted to.
Da Silva said that she was no longer comfortable performing the waxing as she only offered female waxing services and not services on male
hoo-has.
I have no problem with the LGBT people, Da Silva said. In fact, she was willing to offer waxing services for a transgendered woman who had lopped off the...
So had the okay, lopped the invading reproductive organs.
No, this is...
Because that person didn't want those organs, and so they were invading. They're invasive.
Okay.
There was like an invasive species that attacked them at birth.
And now has a female see, you're suck at this.
I suck at this.
Just open up. There's a book over there. Just open up a book and just start grabbing words. Just any word.
First time that Tim Alberta's new book is used in this way. I believe, at least.
All right. Her waxing services for transgendered women who had undergone reassignment surgery and had lost their...
Romney.
Now, see, this works.
That's fucking much better.
To the average outsider, this seems a perfectly reasonable response. To the woke identitarian left, it's an act of bigotry. Yaniv charged that Da Silva was discriminating against her on the basis of her gender identity. Mm-hmm. Such discrimination is barred under Canadian law. During the hearing, Yaniv even compared Da Silva's refusal to wax her...
Boehner. That's an unfortunate one. It didn't work out well. But it's in the book.
As an act of neo-Nazism. Mm-hmm. Naturally, comedians and parody accounts filled the day. So here is the here's the problem, she said. On another level, this is no laughing matter. Mm. While yes, wax my...
Priebus.
Bigot. Case is just one isolated incident, but it shows how the identitarian left has rapidly advanced from pursuing equality, which involves the freedom from oppression, to seek the justice and version of justice, which includes the freedom to force your views or yourself on more literally onto others. This version of social justice poses a threat to a free society. If you could, if Yanov could have gone to a waxing service that accepted both the male
Bannon
and the female
Kushner,
or even
it could be a Bannon. It's actually, go ahead. They sound those words.
Or even bought it a do-it-yourself at home kit. She didn't. Instead, mm-hmm. she relentlessly pursued this case to try to browbeat her fellow citizens into submission. Mm-hmm. Okay, so now here's the problem. You know, anybody who, you know, said, oh, they can just make a wedding cake. Now you're having to also handle the man's Boehner. and is that right? Do you have a right to say no?
How can you not have a right to say no to touch another person's genitals? Isn't this the Me Too party? You're going to force women to touch male genitals because of some ridiculous corner you've backed yourself in on wedding cakes. I mean, it's completely ridiculous, but if you believe that someone should be forced to write words on a cake, then you absolutely have to go along with this. Absolutely. It's a completely consistent.
And isn't it strange that you have to get permission to touch someone's genitals?
They can
take that permission away or say, I didn't give you permission, and then it's sexual harassment and you're in trouble. Mm-hmm. But you can't say no to touching someone's genitals if they are asking you and paying you money as part of your job.
It seems almost mildly inconsistent, I think,
does.
Is what you're getting at.
It does.
It does. But, I mean, I really don't understand how you disagree with it. Like, there is, you can make the, there's some sort of like, well, that seems like it's crossing the line argument. But you don't have a, you don't have an actual consistent moral argument, I don't think there. I mean, look, the easy way here is to err on the side of individual freedom, which we do in this country. In Canada, you know, it's not their gig, right? Like, that's not the they don't have the constitution that we have. They don't have the founding that we have. So you expect things like this to happen in Canada, but that one's coming here.
Now, don't you think that maybe feminists would want to stand up for some, I mean, to be frank with you, I mean, once you've had the reassignment surgery.
Oh, Franks and Beans. That's a good one.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. You know, once you've had the Franks and Beans removed, mm-hmm. You're still the same gender. You're still a guy on the inside. You're still a guy. However, you know, you've committed to it.
Yeah. You've at least.
Somebody who comes in and says, you know, I want my meat and vegetables polished. That's not, I mean, feminists are telling women, you got to do that.
Right. And you know what, what's funny about it is the reason why they have to be consistent on this and say, yeah, you got to go up, you know, the Franks and Beans are there. You got to go do it on the Franks and Beans is because for their worldview to have any level of consistency, they can't admit that that's a man. They have to say that that is a woman on the table with the Franks and Beans.
Do you think they care about consistency? Or is it just forcing people to comply? In all ways, force people right. to comply.
Oh, I think that's part of it. But, I mean, if you have to admit something that fundamentally they can't admit. They can't admit that this is not a girl. This is a boy. This is not a man. This is a woman. They can't say that this is one gender. They have to act as if it's real, right? That's the foundation of this entire issue, is all of these conversations revolve around this premise that something we all know is not true must be, we must pretend that it is true. And if we all pretend that it is true, maybe it will become true.
No,
but that's not how the world works.
No,
that is not how things happen. We can all say, hey, we really care about the national debt. But you know what? We don't. Surprise, surprise. We don't care at all. And I think it's one of those situations where there are certain things that test these realities. And it's the only way I think you push back on it, honestly. Like, you know, the sports thing is another one of them. You know, when your 16-year-old daughter gets destroyed by a 16-year-old boy in a race that she's worked really hard for, parents tend to get pissed off about it. When your 24-year-old daughter works at a waxing place and is waxing guys Franks and beans every day because some activist is telling you that they're not Franks and beans or that women can have Franks and beans, that is a situation where it tends to test people's patience with your little story.
Things tend to break down like they're breaking now. Right now, the Democrats are pushing these ideas so hard, and they are starting to be in, they're starting to leave the classroom and actually be dealt in every person's house. They're dealing with it now in everybody's house. And we're all coming home with our kids going, wait a minute, what are they teaching you? Wait a minute. Who was there in the library? Wait a minute. They asked you to wax what? It's starting to happen. Mm-hmm. And people are, here's why it has gotten out of hand so far, is just like political correctness, nobody wants to hurt anybody else's feelings. Mm-hmm. Nobody wants to hurt anybody's feelings. And if that's what makes you feel better, fine, I'll do it. But when push comes to shove and I've got to testify or I have to tell it to my children or I have to whatever, no, wait. You can live your life that way. And I'll tolerate it. And you'll tolerate me leading my life. And we're not going to say bad things to each other. But I'm not teaching my children that your thinking is right or even healthy in some regards.
And it's moments like this where you know that they don't even believe it, right? If you're fighting back against a woman and that because she has to wax a part she doesn't want to do.
Where's your feminism?
Yeah. You're admitting it. You're admitting that you don't actually believe these things. You're just saying them over and over again and trying to get people fired from their jobs if they say the opposite or getting deplatformed if they say the opposite.
Now, this Franks and Beans story is happening in Canada.
This is the best of the Glenn Beck program.
Alexander Hammond, we had on yesterday. We wanted to touch base with him quickly here. Boris Johnson was elected. He's the new prime minister. Welcome, Alexander.
Hi, Glenn. Thanks for having me. Yes, he has done it. He is now, or tomorrow, he will be walking to number 10 Downing Street as the new prime minister to the UK.
You know, that's one thing that we also don't do. We have like several months in between, but you guys go through these people like water.
We just get right to the point, Glenn. He's won 66% of the vote. He's got a clear consensus to enter and become our next prime minister, and he'll do so soon.
Okay, so how he gets along with Donald Trump, right?
Yeah, so a few years ago, he maybe said not so nice things about Donald Trump. However, since Trump's been elected and since he's been in more senior positions, the rhetoric's been far nicer. Earlier today, once it was announced that Boris will be the next prime minister, Trump tweeted him saying that he will be a great prime minister. Similarly, Ivanka Trump shared the sentiment. However, she said he'll be a great prime minister of United Kingdom. A bit of a spelling error there, but that's okay. Still the same sentiment is being held. So, yeah, they get on. And I'm seeing across so many commentators today across Twitter and everywhere else are saying how similar these two men are. However, I couldn't disagree more. I think they're fundamentally opposed in so many different ways.
In what way?
That idea that they're the same. Well, firstly, Boris Johnson, he ran the Brexit campaign on the idea of creating more free trade to open the UK up to the world.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Trump, I feel, has more protectionist sentiments in regards to his trade wars. Brexiteers wanted a trade deal with China. Trump wanted a trade war with them.
Okay, so hang on. Let me answer these as you go along. I agree with what you just said. You're absolutely right. However, Trump won because there was this feeling from the people that nobody in government was listening to the people, and they were sick and tired of it, and that's what put him into office. Kind of the same thing. Nobody was listening to the people on Brexit, and they got sick and tired of it.
Okay, sure. So I agree that perhaps the sentiment, behind people feeling disenfranchised and angry with the government did propel both Brexit and Trump. However, mm-hmm. the rationale behind both votes were completely different. It was, for example, Boris Johnson is pretty pro-immigration, for example, too. He mm-hmm. favours the Australian point-style system, which basically sees immigrants fill our country depending on the skills they have and our current shortages in our economy. Whereas Trump, I think, is far, far more different on that.
I think Trump would. I think Trump would be okay with if we had a point system. We don't have a point. We have no system now. You just come on in. You're like, hey, I like the red in your flag, and so I'd like to come in, and we let you in. You don't have to have anything to be let in.
Okay, Glenn, I've got you on this final point. So Boris Johnson, he is a classical scholar. He is a historian. You mentioned yesterday how you read his book on Churchill.
Yes.
He often uses utterance from great ancient philosophers in his speeches. He does that all the time. Whereas I don't think we can apply the same intellectual rigor to Trump's speeches.
If you believe,
the same way they come across.
If you wish to dismiss the ancient wisdom of fortune cookies, you may be right.
They're definitely not the same person. No. Right? I mean, there's definitely differences. And the trade thing is one of the biggest, you know, issues, I think. I think the difference with trade in that, like, you know, Daniel Hannan, I thought, was a great voice for Brexit and that he constantly emphasized wanting to open up free trade to the world. And that's definitely not what Trump ran on, though. I will say it's a low priority issue, I think, for most American voters. It's just it's not something that I don't know that Trump got elected because of his trade position.
No,
he got more elected. I think, you know, some people really liked it. Some people really hated it. But they saw it as like it's, you know, it's way down the list and it was not a top priority. Where Brexit, really, that was a big focus.
I don't know. Settle this for us, Alexander, because I would say that the trade thing was probably bigger for the politicians and the elites. But it was the cultural things and the immigration standards and the living up to rules that weren't coming from England that was the main force and driver behind Brexit. Which one is accurate or more accurate?
So I think the trade aspect is really crucially important. Hmm. And unlike with Trump, where you say it was more of a minority issue, for Brexit, on every single thing all the Brexiteers did, it was so we could create a free and open global trading Britain. That's what they said.
Right, but was that what the people were saying? For instance, you could say that Donald Trump, and I don't believe this to be true at all, Donald Trump is a racist that just doesn't like Mexicans. You could say that. You could say that all you want, and that's what you're fighting against. But you wouldn't really be fighting against something that was real, because what the people are saying is, we want to know who's coming across our borders, and we'd like it to be controlled. There's nothing wrong with Mexicans or anybody else from Honduras. It's just we want to make sure that this is a controlled entrance. So are the political elite having that conversation about trade, but the people are saying, no, it's more visceral than that. It's about my heritage, my culture, my country.
Yeah, sure. So following when we did the Brexit referendum on the 23rd of June 2016, all the exit polls that persuaded the Leave voters showed the biggest issue was the diplomatic side, the fact that laws were being made in Brussels mm-hmm. With very little say from the UK mm-hmm. Members of Parliament and how unelected officials were creating our laws. So that was the biggest. And then beneath that, I would say then trade and immigration come into the picture.
Sovereignty is really, I mean, it encompasses all of these issues.
Yeah.
Because trade policy is part of it and immigration policy is part of it.
And I think that's what we feel here in America. Remember, we're a collection of states. We're the union of states, and we're feeling the loss of our sovereignty as states, not the same. We've lost it a long time ago compared to you guys, but we still feel that loss of individual sovereignty. So let me ask you this. You had a British ship taken by Iran. Our Department of State issued a statement, said, you know, Great Britain can take care of their own, issues. So it's not something that involves us. How is Boris Johnson when it comes to war. Donald Trump is not a hawk when it comes to war at all. But he is at least a tough talker. Where's Boris Johnson?
So I'd say Boris Johnson is quite similar in the sense that he doesn't want to be invading Iran, Iraq, Afghanistan anytime soon. He is similarly cautious about ground intervention the same way Donald Trump is. And when he was foreign secretary of the UK between 2016 and 2018, that's when the Russian spy incident in Salisbury happened, when Russian agents were caught using poisonous materials on UK soil and accidentally killed a member of our public. And he was foreign secretary at the time. And instead of trying to jump to military action or any sense, he gathered the nations of the world and, in a joint effort under his leadership, expelled spies. He got every nation to expel spies from their country. And he was more pushing for sanctions on Russia as opposed to any military intervention, which is, I think, is definitely wise and in a similar category to Trump.
Yeah, I think that's good. Okay, Alexander,
Hold on, more question before you go, Alexander. So what I keep reading is if Johnson comes in and tries to do a no-deal Brexit, they will wind up being very upset with him and then call for a new general election, and this whole thing could be changed again. Because I do not understand the scope and the nuance of the parliamentary democracy system.
Yeah, let me boil it down to this. You all seem to have a stick up your butt when it comes to, you know, walking around and, oh, tea time. And then once you close the doors, you have somebody, order, close the doors, and you just wail on each other. What's the deal, dude?
Well, yeah, you're talking about John Bercow, the Speaker of the House of Commons, who is famous.
Whoa.
He shouts order all the
time. Yeah.
So it would be, if a general election is called, it would be because Boris Johnson himself calls it. And the reason he would do that is so that he can get more conservative members of parliament into the government. And what that would mean is he has a greater mandate to pursue Brexit, because at the moment, the conservatives are in power, but they're in power just by a little bit. We're in a minority government being propped up by other parties. So a general election could be called so that conservatives get a bigger proportion of the vote, and that would give him the power to more easily pursue a no-deal Brexit.
And let's just say they go in there and they just fight with each other and they can't come up with any deal, they can't come up with anything. Does it just automatically go into effect, a no-deal Brexit, on the 31st?
Yes, the default setting in law is that we're leaving on the 31st of October, and the only way they could overcome that is if a new law is created. But Boris Johnson and his cabinet will likely be Brexiteers who have committed to the no-deal deadline, will have to sign it off.
So why would he call for a general election that he could lose if he could just wait and let Brexit go through?
Well, it would basically give him more legitimacy and a bigger mandate in the Houses of Parliament to push forward his agenda, as opposed to creating more of an uproar than it would otherwise.
And do you think he would win that?
I think he would. So between 2008 and 2016, he was mayor of London. And London is a pretty far-left liberal city. And it had Ken Livingstone, who was essentially a Marxist, grain to Jeremy Corbyn. And he managed to defeat him by a huge margin. And in the UK, in the European elections, which were held in May, the Brexit Party won a huge proportion of the vote. They won 31% of the vote, whereas Conservatives under the Remainer, Theresa May, only won 9%. So what Boris Johnson basically represents is he can unite the Brexit vote to be able to defeat Jeremy Corbyn, because he will unite all of the people who voted for Farage, because he stands on the same policies pretty much in regards to Brexit. Whilst he maintains the Conservative vote, which should keep Jeremy Corbyn out of power, because both the Brexit Party and the Conservatives definitely don't want a Marxist in government, and rightly so.
Yeah. Corbyn is bad news. Alexander, thank you so much. Appreciate it. We'll talk again.
Thank you, Aaron.
All right. Bye-bye. Alexander Hammond, he is from Young Voices. You can find him at Young Voices.
You're listening to the best of the Glenn Beck program.
We have Stephen Kent. He is a spokesperson from Young Voices. He's also the host of Beltway Banthas podcast, which I am appearing on in a couple of weeks. We'll talk about that perhaps if we have time. But he's responding to a Huffington Post story, Behold the Millennial Nuns. Welcome, Stephen. How are you?
Hey, good morning, Glenn.
Good morning. So tell me about the story from Huffington Post.
Yeah, well, I think we both read it, mm-hmm. and this story in the Huffington Post by Eve Fairbanks sort of chronicles this young woman looking at her friend group growing up, all becoming more religious over time, and not only becoming more religious, but becoming Catholic, and then a large amount of them seeking out the life of nuns. And this isn't a group of like social media influencer type girls who travel the world, they're lifestyle Instagrammers, they're bloggers, they're the kind who kind of like wear their faith on their sleeve mm-hmm. and do it very loudly and proudly, but really seeking out a life of really rigid boundaries in a way that you just wouldn't expect. You wouldn't really expect this from millennials, right? Mm-hmm. But it turns out, and Eve Fairbanks looks into this, that numbers are rising across the country, that people seeking out the life of nuns is actually dramatically higher than it was years before. And the average age is 24. Blew my mind, but it also makes perfect sense.
Why does it make sense?
Well, you said this on my podcast over the weekend, that young people are starving for truth. Mm-hmm. They live in a subjective world. It is a subjective generation by and large, where the world today seems to tell you that it can be whatever you want it to be and that there is nothing that is right and wrong. There mm-hmm. is no black and white. And I think that is not squaring with a certain subset of millennials who are looking for something deeper.
I think that eventually really falls into recognition of the majority of people, no matter what age.
Yeah.
You can live that life for a while where, you know, it's just my truth that matters. But it will cause massive pain in your life. And if you ever want to get out of it, you're going to have to recognize that there are some universal truths that are just not changed.
Yeah, there was this this girl in this study, or in this piece, that had said that when she was speaking to the Huffington Post, she said, there is nothing consistent in the secular world. It all is a moving target. Catholicism, by contrast, truth is a fact, and your obligations to other people and God cannot be trumped by personal truth. That spoke to me as well. I mean, this is sort of the thing that I deal with in my own life, with my own generation. And I think a certain part of the Protestant population, I grew up Presbyterian, I now go to a non-denominational church. And there does seem to be, in this religious community, still a take it or leave it approach to religion, right? Pick what you want, a la carte. And it's not authentic.
And it doesn't really work.
There's something wrong there.
Yeah.
The end of the study had talked about this research that was done by the Barna Group, mm-hmm. and it showed that millennials, by and large, when they are asked about this issue, millennials of faith, they are asked about this issue, and they prefer traditional churches, they prefer cathedral settings, they prefer the preacher behind a pew as opposed to standing up and being like a motivational mm-hmm. TED Talk speaker. Mm-hmm. We're swinging backwards. I mean, I think this has everything to do with millennials like building carpenter style houses and wanting craft coffee. Mm-hmm. They don't want Keurig. They want the real thing. And some of them are going very far to find it. None is quite extreme, but I think that's the whole point. They're the OMG generation. They do everything a little bit over the top.
I think there's something to be said right now. Everything is personalized, you know, in somebody's life. You can get it exactly the way you want it.
Yeah.
I grew up in the generation where McDonald's was like, no, it's the Big Mac. That's the way we make it. You don't like it, go pound
it's
sand.
It's in the heating lamp.
Our Big Macs yesterday were very customized, yeah. I would like to say.
So it's, I mean, that's just the way it was growing up, because we were still in the, you know, the mass production, you know, world where we thought mass production was great. Because, you know, 100 years before, it hadn't been mass production. Well, now that we've had mass production, now we're looking for things that are unique and customizable and uniquely us. The idea of of swinging back to the old world, I think, starts there. Is something handmade? Is it for the individual? That kind of stuff makes a difference, and it goes back to making things by hand or being quiet. When the world is screaming, there's going to be a yearning for a quiet place. When everything is loud and vibrant, there's something too, a big, dark cathedral that is absolutely silent.
I mean, it would also speak to the rise in yoga and meditation as being something that people are seeking out. They're tired. They're everywhere they go, they're stimulated. And people don't have the discipline now in their daily lives to actually be in a place of quiet.
There's not, I was thinking about this the other day, because I think we're approaching the moment that the Beatles did Revolution, which is 1969. And 1969 was the year that all this nonsense just started to come apart and fall apart. And that was the year of Altamont. And there was stabbings at these peace festivals like Woodstock. We had gone through the shootings of JFK, Malcolm X, RFK, MFK, Martin Luther King. And people were sick of it. They were just sick of it. And there was this moment where the Beatles stepped out and said, "You want to hold and carry around pictures of Chairman Mao? We want to change your head anyhow. No one will follow you." And they made a statement of, "You know what? We're not with you." And that one iconic band, even though they had all of this music that was supporting this debauchery, which they don't have now. There is no cultural, there's no cultural tie that ties all of this progressivism and nonsense of how many genders there are. There's no iconic look or music, you know, like there was in the 1960s. The one thing that accompanied the change was a revival of the churches. There was the Jesus movement, and it didn't go back to the cathedrals. It went to, hey, you know, Jesus is a cool guy, and Jesus, that was a good example.
Changed my relationship status to in a relationship with the Lord.
Yes. Yeah, right. And that's the one thing that's missing. When that starts to happen, I think it will officially be on the downslope of this insanity.
Yeah. I mean, I just relate with this entire thing, you know, where I've been on the search for my own church for the past 10 years since I left home. I'm 29. So I went to college, fell out of church, then tried to get back in, but started going to sort of these like rock band churches, right? Where it's like a TED talk and then there's bands playing. I just felt oppressed by the cheese. I couldn't do it. And I've just found myself over time just longing for my Presbyterian church growing up where they sang hymns, right? Mm-hmm. And you were like the only young person in the pew.
They didn't have any projectors to show you the words on the screen.
Yeah, like, and I thought I was an outlier. But this entire piece in the HuffPost says that is actually a trend right now that is swinging.
It's really strange because my faith, if we don't have projectors, it's against rules to use projectors.
Yeah, you talk very traditional, right?
Very traditional. Mm-hmm. All old hymns. It's an organ. I mean, it is as traditional as it comes. And a lot of people in my faith are like, Could we
turn the lights on? Is that possible?
Could we have heat? I mean, and this whole thing has come and gone, or is starting to wane, of the big loud churches. And I like occasionally going in. I mean,
I'm not as negative on it. But like, I think that's the whole point, right? Like,
there's good ones and bad ones.
Yeah, the choice is important, right? I think there's some things that it depends on what serves you best, right? Yeah. What furthers the end mission.
And you go to a really good one, though. You go to a really good. Gateway is a good.
The particular music is really good.
And your
really
past
good.
Guest, Mark Batterson, I used to go to his churches when I lived in Washington, D.C. Fantastic. Yeah, really great balance. And that actually was not necessarily the rock band style churches, the TED Talk speaker. It was the movie theater church. And I actually really liked that. I connected with it. Just being right there, seat to seat next to everybody. It was very cool. That was a model that worked for me.
A lot of people are going to Church's Chicken here in Texas, which is...
it's where I get all of my religious experiences.
There's no preaching, but...
Jesus, this is good chicken. Okay.
A little different.
Stephen, it's good to talk to you. Good to have you.
Wait, before you go, Star Wars.
What about it?
What, like, so we have... Your podcast is about Star Wars and politics, like the fusion, the intersection of those. What is happening? We have this, the ninth Star Wars coming out. Mm-hmm. This is back to J.J. Abrams, right?
It is.
Give us a little rundown of like the news of Star Wars, because it's really, I care about it much more than anything
else. Okay, Star Wars news. Here we go. All right, so this movie is coming out December 20th, Episode 9, The Rise of Skywalker. It is going to be good, I think. If you're trying to come out of The Last Jedi downturn, we're going to end with J.J. Abrams back at the helm as a cinematic guy. And we are going to get a more basic approach to Star Wars, I think, that actually rounds this all down. Now, what I want to say is that I'm not nearly excited about Episode 9 as I am about what's coming out on Disney Plus, the new Disney equivalent of Netflix here in November. The Mandalorian. How many people in your audience grew up wanting that Boba Fett movie? Wanting to be the bounty hunter.
Oh, yeah.
Well, now you're going to get it, ladies and gentlemen. Mm. The Mandalorian stars Pablo Pascal from Game of Thrones. And it's going to be an Old West style sort of desert flick where the Mandalorian bounty hunter, unnamed at this point, is roaming an Imperial owned planet to hunt down sort of like people deserting the Empire.
Oh, right? I'm all in on this.
I mean, that's all that you need from Star Wars.
I'm
going
to have to get
point.
Another subscription. I'll cancel the police.
Yeah, okay. That's all that you need.
That's amazing. That one sounds great.
Oh, yeah.
So it's not Boba Fett per se, but it is a bounty hunter
movie.
Yeah,
just another Mandalorian.
All right.
Yeah.
And you said the guy who did, Rian Johnson did the last one.
He was slated for his own trilogy that was going to start in a brand new timeline, not involve Skywalkers. There were rumors it might be the Old Republic where you had like Jedi armies and Sith armies. Mm-hmm. But Disney went back on the agreement and they have actually moved away from doing another movie with Rian Johnson.
Why?
I mean, you just have to assume that The Last Jedi just was
sucked.
It was so tough for so many people.
So is this do we know is this the last of the original story?
That is what they say, right? But kind of they always say this about different movies.
Right.
Like, no, we are done with this. JK, 5 years later, there'll be another one.
Right.
But they have been very clear that the Skywalker story, as we know it, that's the standout quote, as we know it, is over after Episode 9.
Well, who's left?
There is no one left, right?
And that, so it and kind that, of really,
but
it
that
ends
goes,
last
But
time.
That goes to the whole name, The Rise of Skywalker. Who are they talking about? Mm-hmm. And then I have my theory. Would you like to hear it?
Can I take a break and come back? I got to take a break.
I don't know. Do we want a theory, though? I feel like sometimes...
I love theories. Right, I love theories.
Glenn
okay.
loves it.
The Blaze Radio Network. On demand.